Welcome to Democracy Nerd. I am Jefferson Smith. The Supreme Court just announced a series of far-reaching, shall we say, decisions, incendiary decisions, perhaps, precedent-shattering decisions, perhaps. We will discuss how we even characterize them, and I will even ask that of our guest. We'll do more to look back at the Supreme Court's 2023 term. Today, in particular, we want to look at Moore versus Harper, in which a majority of justices rejected the independent state legislature theory. Maybe I should call it the so-called independent state legislature theory. Some of the relevance of that case is what didn't happen. So, depending on the interest and time of our honored guest, we might go beyond that case and talk about some of the others. So, as a result, at least for the moment, maybe democracy wasn't shattered in the United States. Maybe, perhaps, joining us to talk about that decision and maybe some of the others is Eliza Swerin Becker, Senior Counsel for the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Eliza, hello and welcome to Democracy Nerd.
Thank you so much. It's really lovely to be here with you, and I'm excited to chat all things Moore versus Harper.
So let's first, even before introducing you a little bit, let's just tease the thing. When I say that Moore versus Harper at least avoided destroying democracy, how hyperbolic am I being?
I don't think you're being all that hyperbolic, to be honest. The theory that was offered in Moore versus Harper, the independent state legislature theory, if the Supreme Court had reversed over 100 years of precedent and rejected all of the historic evidence, it would have been catastrophic for our democracy. I think it really would have sowed chaos in our elections. It would have undermined the way that state legislatures operate in the context of their checks and balances, and it could have wreaked havoc on voting rights throughout the country. So there was a real danger here, and I think the crisis was averted. Many years ago now, I decided to go to law school coming out of a sort of academic think tanky environment because I wanted to work more actively and directly with people to help protect and advance civil rights broadly. And the right to vote is what Dr. King called civil right number one. It's the right that protects all of our other civil rights. If we can uphold and protect voting rights, we can then hopefully make progress on other fundamental rights. So I was really drawn to doing democracy work because of the centrality of voting in our system overall.
Where'd you go to law school?
I went to Harvard.
And who did you have for constitutional law?
Among others, Professor Klarman, Professor Noah Feldman, Professor Tushnet, all teaching different parts of the Constitution.
Were you sure you were going to do good and righteous work when you were in law school, or were you thinking that that was a sucker's bet?
I was pretty hopeful that I would be able to do good and righteous work out of law school. I mean, the challenge coming out of law school is actually harder to find a job in the nonprofit sector than it is to find a job at law firms.
There's not as many jobs.
Yeah.
And where did you live when you were there?
I lived on Chauncey Street, and then I lived on Sumner Road.
So not on campus?
Not on campus.
All right. I went to the same law school. So and what did you do right after?
Immediately after law school, I did a legal fellowship at the ACLU in the Speech Privacy and Technology Project, working on First Amendment and privacy issues.
So, and I want to thank you for what you're doing now, because, and I think you named it, you know, I think you shared that experience, that the more typical thing to do is to go work for, you know, Wall Street law firm, or, you know, the equivalent of Wall Street law firm outside Wall Street. But but it turns out that what you're doing is not only more precious, it's more precious because it's more rare. And I want to thank you also for doing it, because I know many more people, frankly, I was one of them, who went to law school with the best of intentions and not follow through on all those intentions. So thank you for what you're doing. What does a senior counsel at the Brennan Center do? Are you filing lawsuits? Are you writing papers? Are you doing amicus briefs? Like, what's your job?
Good question. I just want to note that I'm really lucky to be able to do what I do and really privileged. And also want to say that I worked at a law firm for a couple of years, so I don't want to mislead anybody. I think that was super valuable experience too, and don't begrudge anybody doing that. But to your question, so I work at the Brennan Center, and that is a nonpartisan organization that's part think tank, part advocacy organization, and part public interest law firm. And we focus on reforming, revitalizing, and when necessary, defending our country's systems of democracy and justice. As a senior counsel at the Brennan Center, I get to use all of those mutually reinforcing tools. I conduct research and write and put out articles or op-eds. I engage in federal and state and local advocacy, offering testimony to Congress or to state legislatures. And I litigate to protect and advance voting rights. So the real answer is all of the above. And it's one of the things I love about my job is that I get to use a bunch of the different tools in the toolbox to try to reach a goal.
What do you think were the most important decisions in this last Supreme Court term? I assume you'll include Moore versus Harper in there. Maybe you'd include it at the top. Maybe you wouldn't. What are the big ones? Because, and by the way, the ones you say, I might want to ask you about.
Well, to be very clear, I am focused on the democracy and election-related issues, so happy to speak about the other cases, but I will do so from a much less informed place. Having said that, I do think Moore versus Harper and the Merrill decision were incredibly consequential for our democracy. But in those two particular decisions, we had good outcomes. But of course, I think the court did lots of damage to civil rights during this term in the affirmative action decisions. And in the, I don't know even how to characterize it, religious liberty with respect to discriminating against LGBTQ people. So in the gay rights and affirmative action decisions, I think we lost some ground.
Yeah. Is it maybe the right to discriminate based on religion, the right for use your religion as justification to discriminate?
I suppose that's where the court thinks it is.
So let's dig into Moore versus Harper a little bit. Let's start with the facts of the case. And looking back a little bit, even to a 2019 case where the Supreme Court ruled that federal courts could not review partisan gerrymandered maps, but racially drawn maps were still under review of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Give sort of the background facts that would be useful to inform the discussion.
So that's right. In 2019, in a case called Rucho, the Supreme Court said that as far as partisan gerrymanders go, the U.S. Constitution has nothing to say about them, and the issue is non-justiciable in federal courts. So essentially, the Supreme Court closed federal courthouse doors to claims of partisan gerrymandering, no matter how extreme, no matter how unrepresentative the maps. At the same time, claims that maps were drawn in a racially discriminatory way could still be brought in federal court, including under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. After the Rucho decision in 2019, the North Carolina legislature drew new congressional districts in the state after the census and drew an extreme partisan gerrymander. The litigants, the voting organizations, the voters in North Carolina said, oh, hey, I know what to do. The U.S. Supreme Court told us what to do. They said in Rucho, we could go to the state Supreme Court and vindicate our rights under our state constitution. Because in foreclosing federal court relief to partisan gerrymandering in Rucho, the court said, you have another answer. You can get relief in state courts. And that's exactly what the litigants in North Carolina did. They went to their state courts. They said, this is an extreme partisan gerrymander. It's barred by our state constitution. You should strike it down. Ultimately, that's exactly what the North Carolina Supreme Court did. The court struck down the partisan gerrymander and told the state legislators to go back and draw a new map. They drew another gerrymandered map, and they were told that that violated the constitution as well. And so a new map was drawn at the direction of the court to be fair and representative of the people of North Carolina. Rather than accept that outcome, some North Carolina legislators asked the U.S. Supreme Court to bail them out. And they asked the U.S. Supreme Court to say that the state constitution and the state courts could not constrain them when they made rules for federal elections. And that is a profound and dangerous idea, that the state legislators get to violate their own constitution. But that is precisely the idea at the center of the independent state legislature theory.
Independent state legislature theory, sort of perfect chance to segue to that. What the heck is it? And I think I have some basic understanding. And my basic understanding is that they say what the state legislature says in a state is primary, is ultimate, is the only thing that matters, unfettered by whatever a state court might say about it. That's my sort of simplistic understanding of it. Give us a better understanding of it. And to the extent that simplistic understanding says anything, how the heck did they come up with that?
So, yes. What is the independent state legislature theory? It is a seemingly benign collection of four words that all generally sound good and inoffensive, which I think is by design.
No, people like independent things, state legislatures, every state has them. We don't want a dependent, we don't want a tethered, we don't want a totally hidebound state legislature. We want them to be able to act independently, of course.
Yeah, so it's a collection of words that sounds good that I think is meant to hand wave over the very, very dangerous consequences that the theory would bring to bear if it were ever adopted. The theory arises from an interpretation of the Elections Clause of the U.S. Constitution. And that clause gives to states the power to regulate federal elections. Of course, that clause also gives Congress the power, the overriding power, to make or alter any laws that states make for federal elections. And proponents of the independent state legislature theory read the word legislature as it is used in that constitutional provision to give state legislators near exclusive authority over federal elections. They believe that the Elections Clause would prohibit any other state entity, like state courts or governors, or any constraints from state constitutions, from placing checks and balances on the state legislative power when the legislators are making rules for federal elections. That is a false reading of the Constitution, but that is where the idea comes from.
How did they come up with this? Say more about where it comes from. When you say it's a false reading, make their case for them with or without a tongue in your cheek.
Sure. So the language of the Elections Clause reads, "The times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed by each state and the legislature thereof. And so proponents say, look, the Elections Clause uses the word legislature. It has to mean legislature. We all know what a legislature is. That's it. Of course, if you look at the rest of the provision of the Elections Clause, which also gives Congress the power to make or alter those rules, nobody would ever say that Congress has the power to make rules for federal elections without any constitutional constraints from the U.S. Constitution or without needing to present legislation to the president for his signature or veto, or without the possibility of review by federal courts. The word legislature, just like the word Congress, is intended to be used as part of the ordinary lawmaking power in the state. So just like Congress has to send bills to the president for a signature or veto, the state legislature has to send bills to a governor for signature or veto. The state legislature is constrained by their state constitution. The state legislature is subject to judicial review when it legislates on elections. All of those things are equally true for states as they are for Congress. And when you look at the history behind the Elections Clause, it is absolutely unequivocally clear that the framers never would have given special unchecked authority to state legislators to make rules for federal elections. The framers were deeply, deeply distrustful of state lawmakers, and they were trying to figure out ways to corral and constrain them, not liberate them from the shackles of checks and balances.
the proponents of the independent state legislature. I want to get into the roots. Who are these people?
There are not very many. And there are a handful of folks in academia who have advanced the independent state legislature theory. There are a handful of Supreme Court justices who have expressed support for or interest in the independent state legislature theory. And there were amicus briefs in support of the North Carolina legislators in the U.S. Supreme Court. But those briefs came from almost uniformly partisan entities, individuals, and not from the historians, the election officials, the governors, the academics, the state Supreme Court justices, the very many bipartisan folks who weighed in against the theory.
Any funding links to be aware of? Who's helping pay for the think tanky stuff to come up with this? Is it all coming out of the tower of the university, or are there more, as you would say, sort of partisan drivers involved?
The theory really isn't coming out of universities or academic institutions, and the entities that weighed in support of the theory are these partisan organizations that are, right-wing affiliated organizations advancing right-wing political goals. So I don't particularly do research into the flow of money and how these things get advanced, but this is not a theory that finds support in the mainstream or finds support in academics who spent a lot of time looking into the history or reading language of the founders. This is really has been advanced in recent years by partisan interests, including in 2020 by the former president and the RNC.
In last year, almost exactly a year ago, in an op-ed for the LA Times, you described it as a debunked legal theory that would turn elections into chaos. Other analysis referred to the ISL theory as fringe. How did it get to the Supreme Court? And I don't mean like, how does a bill become a law? I mean, how did cert get granted? I'm guessing it was the same three justices who were the three votes in the minority on the case, but how did they even decide to review it? How did this pass a straight face test?
That's a great question. And I think it goes back to 2020 and to the former president and the RNC. In 2020, in the heat of the pandemic, we saw governors, we saw election boards, and we saw decisions by state courts that all made policy changes to make it easier for voters to cast their ballots during the pandemic. And in attacking those changes, President Trump and the RNC sued and said, hey, that court, that election board, that governor, they're not the legislature. They don't get to make changes of the rules for federal elections. Only the legislature does. These policies violate what the legislature has written out in statute, and therefore these policies need to be overturned. Ultimately, they were advancing the independent state legislature theory in 2020 to try to stop these policies from being implemented during the election. They lost in virtually all of those cases. And then after the election, they went back to court and said, those votes that were cast in reliance on those policies adopted by executive order or a policy from an election board, those votes have to be tossed out because they were cast they were cast consistent with these policies adopted by people who never had the authority to begin with. So you, Supreme Court, have to throw out their votes. So we saw claims like that coming out of North Carolina and Pennsylvania, for example. Again, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected those arguments, but in doing so, some of the justices wrote separate opinions saying, I might have granted emergency relief, or I'm interested in this theory. Legislature must mean legislature. come back again another time presenting this theory, maybe not in an emergency posture right after an election asking us to throw out votes, but this has the ring of truth to it, and we're interested in adjudicating this independent state legislature theory thing. They didn't exactly use those words. So we heard from several justices expressing that support and expressing that interest in 2020 and inviting another case presenting the theory to the court. And that's exactly what happened in North Carolina. The North Carolina legislators said, hey, I think we've got an interested audience and we don't like what our state Supreme Court did. Let's go to the US Supreme Court. At least four justices are willing to entertain this idea because they granted cert last June. And that's how the Supreme Court effectively, or at least some of the justices on the court effectively invited the independent state legislature theory to be offered and considered by the court.
So who are the four? Let's do vote counting, because it's a legislative, at this point the Supreme Court is a legislative body. It's just a legislative body that gets to serve forever, and pretending that it is something other than that is misleading us. Our honored guest can argue with me on that point, but who are the four votes?
We don't know for sure. The Supreme Court doesn't report the vote count when it grants cert. Sometimes you know who voted against or for because they write separately. And we did see separate writings in 2020 from Justice Alito, from Justice Thomas, from Justice Gorsuch, and from Justice Kavanaugh. So that's a pretty good bet on who the four votes were. Not all of them wrote individually. Some of them joined other separate opinions. I think that's a well-informed guess as to who the four votes were for granting cert. It may have been more than four justices who were interested in at least adjudicating this theory and perhaps rejecting it, as the court ultimately did.
So forgive me if I'm going backwards, but 2015, Arizona State Legislature versus Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission. They dealt with this. They said that that ISL theory is rejected. I don't know how squarely that was or how much in dicta, but corporations were viewed as people through originally dicta in the Supreme Court. Sometimes that stuff counts. How did that, correct me where I'm wrong, or help us understand that part?
You're absolutely right. In 2015, the Supreme Court upheld the power of an independent redistricting commission in Arizona to draw congressional districts. The challenge there was that this body was not the legislature and it was not constituted by the legislature. It was constituted as a result of a ballot initiative adopted by the people of Arizona. But a majority of the court there in the Arizona case said, what legislature means is the lawmaking apparatus in the state. It doesn't mean legislature as narrowly defined, the bicameral institution that passes legislation. It's the lawmaking, it's the entire lawmaking scheme in a state. In Arizona, that includes ballot initiatives and it includes this redistricting commission. Notably, the chief wrote a pretty stinging dissent disagreeing with that majority in the 2015 Arizona case. And so when the Moore case came up for cert and was being contemplated, it was not exactly clear where the chief was going to land, because he had written this very sharp dissent arguing that legislature has to mean something in the Constitution. But he also wrote the Rucho decision several years later, which, as I said, closed the door to federal partisan gerrymandering claims, but very clearly stated that partisan gerrymandering claims could be brought in state courts under state constitutions, which suggests that the chief believed and does believe that state courts and state constitutions can place limits on state legislatures. So there was this tension in the recent jurisprudence from the chief, and we saw that resolved in his writing the majority opinion and more squarely rejecting the independent state legislature, I think, once and for all.
So if I'm counting noses, is you've got your guess about the folks who are in favor of cert. If you have the Chief Justice who wrote a dissent in the opinion that would have, or purportedly, or maybe some people thought, had set aside the independent state legislature theory, then it seems like you can count up to five pretty quick. How worried were you when this case was appearing before the Supreme Court?
I think it's fair to say we were worried because of all those previous writings that we've discussed. We think we knew where some of the justices were, but of course you can never be sure. But we also knew that we really had the facts and the law on our side on this one. The historical evidence, the legal precedents, everything is very clearly refuting the independent state legislature theory. And we strongly believe that if the court were to consider this theory on the merits, as opposed to in an emergency posture, and with all of the historical evidence that we thought could be put before the court, which really wasn't entirely available at the time that the court heard the Arizona case that was decided in 2015, we believe that given all of this mountain of evidence, that there was a way to win. We thought this was a winnable case, even though, as you say, when you're counting noses and you're looking at the past writings, it definitely was an uphill battle.
So I'm going to try to give my, you know, sort of dumb kid's explanation. I'm going to actually read the elections clause, all right? And or at least what the internet purports to be the election clause, and I think the internet is correct. So the times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. Okay, so that is essentially the prima facie case. That is essentially the fundamental argument of the ISL nut jobs. They're saying, no, I just called them that, so I'm not taking it back. So it says it right there. It doesn't say by the courts or by the governor or by commissions or anything else. It just says by the legislature thereof. But wait, let me finish the clause. But the Congress may at any time by law make or alter such regulations except as the places of choosing senators. So it then says Congress can at any time make a law. But by that, it doesn't mean they could make a law without the president. Doesn't mean they could make a law without judicial review. So you don't have to go to some other weird part of the Constitution or some latter amendment or some other thing. If you just read the whole thing, it says it right there that there should be a well-regulated militia. Oh, wait, sorry, that's another amendment entirely. It says it right there. And so I think that's the counterargument, right? The counterargument is, yeah, It's when it says legislature, it means legislature the same way it means Congress, which is subject to the overall rules. It sort of stands in. It could have said the state or the federal government, and instead it said legislature and Congress. And we all know what that means now.
That's right. It certainly says the word legislature. Nobody's going to deny that. But I think like any good textualist, you can't just pluck the word out of context and define it in a vacuum. You have to define the words as they're used in context in the Constitution, in that provision of the Constitution, in the Constitution more broadly, and in the historical context. And if you look at the debates, the constitutional debates at the Constitutional Convention, if you look at the debates about ratifying the Constitution in the states at the time that the Constitution was ratified, and the pamphlets and the letters sent back and forth and the Federalist Papers, all of that shows you that the founders were very concerned about state lawmakers basically doing voter suppression. They used strikingly modern language, worrying that polling places were going to be put in inconvenient locations, worrying that lines were going to be drawn in a way to keep partisan factions in power, AKA gerrymandering. They worried about exactly the kinds of abuses of power that state lawmakers have been undertaking in recent years in particular. And as a result, they added this second part of the elections clause, the ability of Congress to make or override any rules that the states made. And they did that because they wanted to constrain state lawmakers. So it would be implausible to the founders that somehow you would then read the word legislature out of context to allow those same lawmakers that they deeply distrusted to operate without the checks and balances of the state courts, of the governor, of the Constitution. So if you look at it textually, if you look at it historically, if you look at it in the way that the Supreme Court has reviewed this provision of the Constitution for over 100 years, all of that points in one direction, which is there is no independent state legislature theory. And fortunately, the court agreed.
So talk to us about the opinion itself. We know it was a 6-3 opinion. We know that Justice Roberts wrote the majority opinion. We know that it was Thomas who wrote a dissent, setting aside the dissent for a moment. What do we learn from that opinion? What is now the law of the land? You can get into rationale and reasoning too. That's great because that helps inform the law of the land. But what do we know now?
The law of the land is there is no independent state legislature doctrine. There is no independent state legislature theory. There is no independent state legislature. The court was very clear that there is no special scenario for legislators when they are making rules for federal elections. They are subject to the same checks and balances that they are always subject to, no matter whether they're making rules for elections or making appropriations or making any other kind of law. They are not exempt from their constitution. They are not exempt from state judicial review. The court was unequivocal about that, that there's nothing independent about the legislature when it comes to the checks and balances of making state law.
What goes into preparation? So maybe that's too quick a pivot, but it's where my mind went. So you're preparing for this. And now imagine you're treating it as a legislature. And you're trying to pass a bill. If you're doing this in U.S. Senate, you got to count 51, right? Or maybe 60 if you're trying to avoid a blockage. Then you think about, if you're Lyndon Johnson or if you're somebody else, you think about what motivates these people, right? Who can get to them and or what gets to them? What are their constituents worried about? What are the hometown polls say? What's their donor base? How do they see the world? What have they worked on in their past? How can we connect with them on something that they already care about? It seems to me that stuff doesn't become less important if what you're trying to do is count to 5 instead of 51 or 60. What does it look like when counsel is preparing for the Supreme Court? Is it strictly just, hey, we're just going to make argument based? I clerk for a federal judge. I saw, you know, I read the memos, but you don't know when you're writing to the appellate court. You don't know who your judges are going to be, at least early on, right? When you start that process. But you know, if your case is going to make its way to the Supreme Court, you know who the legislature is. You know who the decision makers are. You know the board of directors that are voting. What kind of preparation goes into that? And how much does it impact the arguments that are made?
Well, to be clear, the Brennan Center was not an attorney representing a party.
I get that.
And we weren't parties in the case. But the parties who were the respondents in the case, along with the Brennan Center as an amicus in the case and the many other amici who weighed in support of respondents, thought deeply about what are the most persuasive arguments, period, and what are the most persuasive arguments to the justices who are sitting on the court. And the previous terms were instructive in terms of how much focus the court put on history and tradition. And certainly if you look at the amicus briefs in support of respondents, if you look at the respondents' own party briefs, there was a lot of emphasis on history, on the understanding of the Constitution at the founding, on the practice at the founding. So what did state constitutions do at the founding? Did they limit rules for federal elections? There was also a lot of focus on state judicial review around the time of the founding, and evidence brought forth to show that state judicial review was present at the time of the founding and it was applicable also to rules related to elections. So you saw a set of arguments put forth in support of respondents and by the respondents themselves that was directed to the interpretive methods that many justices on the court have used to understand the Constitution. You also saw arguments made by amici of all political stripes and of all, you know, outside of their particular silos. So you saw the Conference of Chief Justices of every state Supreme Court in the country, every highest court in the country. They wrote a brief saying there is no independent state legislature theory, and this would do enormous damage to our system of judging in states. You saw election officials of both parties. You saw governors of both parties. You saw lawyers from the Republican Party, including, you know, a Republican lawyer who represented the Republicans in Bush versus Gore, saying there is no independent state legislature theory and it would wreak enormous havoc on our system of elections and our system of government if the court were to adopt it. So the court heard from a very wide variety of speakers who were all saying essentially the same thing, not because they were coordinated, but because it is the truth that the independent state legislature theory has no basis in history, it has no basis in law, it has no basis in practice, and the Supreme Court has rejected it for over 100 years. This is not something that is deeply rooted in the traditions of American history or law. This is a fringe idea that is very dangerous and the court should reject it. So I think there was a very concerted effort to speak to the justices directly, but also to present the best evidence and to marshal all the evidence that there was to make the most persuasive case no matter what.
We look at the vote breakdown. And we know that Thomas Gorsuch and Alito were in the dissent, and that lets us know that Sotomayor and Kagan and Jackson were in the majority. We know that Roberts wrote it. And we also see that Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett joined, but that Kavanaugh also filed a concurring opinion. What does this let us know about where this Supreme Court is now? And I'm going to ask that in two ways, because I'm jumping ahead a little bit too quickly. So one is, anything more? So independent state legislature theory is dead. Any other sort of related conclusions that should inform our understanding of democracy going forward, elections going forward, that presuppose further cases? And if not, then what tea leaves might it allow us to read, right? What magic eight ball might it suggest for the future?
So you're right that the court made very clear that the independent state legislature theory is dead. There is no independent legislature when it comes to federal elections. But the court also said that federal courts have a role to play in ensuring that state courts don't evade the federal constitution. And the court was very clear that federal courts, that the Supreme Court, can only intervene if a state court isn't judging normally. It emphasized that if the state court was undertaking its ordinary review of state legislative decisions, that there was no role for federal courts to play. But it did suggest that if a state court action is extraordinary, that the Supreme Court might step in to protect what is in the federal constitution. So while state checks and balances remain in place, and that is absolute, the court articulated this role for itself to exercise some degree of oversight with respect to what state courts do. We don't know exactly what that means or how it is going to be exercised. We don't know if the U.S. Supreme Court will ever exercise that power. But we do know that we are now in a position to superintend that situation closely to make sure that the court holds to that extraordinary trigger before it gets involved, to make sure that only in cases of extraordinary departure from normal judging in state courts would the Supreme Court get involved. So that's really the second part of the majority opinion addresses that issue.
Still on sort of voting rights and districting and voter suppression, et cetera, what are now the most important things at issue? What is it? What doors does that open in terms of what Congress or legislature should or shouldn't do? What doors that open or close, other than ones you've already been really clear about, with respect to state legislatures and courts? Sort of what now?
I don't think that really opens any new doors. Certainly, you might have very aggressive litigants try to take advantage of that, the court's articulation of its oversight role of state courts, and to try to push the Supreme Court to interfere in state court decisions. But I think that is unlikely given the rest of the context of the opinion, in which the US Supreme Court was very clear in its support for state judicial review and said repeatedly that as long as state courts are doing their ordinary jobs, there's no role for federal courts, for the US Supreme Court to play. So it remains to be seen exactly how that will play out, but I don't think that this invites a new wide swath of litigation. I think that it is an articulation of a risk that exists, one that we will watch very closely, and that we are in a position to protect and ensure that the state hews very closely to the limited role that it articulated in the decision.
So
I don't know if that answers your question.
No, that helps. That helped. And the way I read the sort of early announcement of the opinion, and I was hosting a national radio show that day, and I was kind of I had to respond. We reported on it like immediately, right? Like within minutes of it getting out. And so I had to make some comment. And we'd been following the case, and so I was able to make some mildly, you know, informed comment even prior to reading the opinion. But the way I viewed it, so, you know, Judge Luttig said this is the most important, you know, like put it up with one of the most important cases ever decided. The way I would put it is not necessarily fundamentally different than that, but it was crisis averted. It wasn't justice achieved. It was cataclysm diverted away from, right? So that's kind of, and that's essentially what you said as well. Friend of mine, and Alex Aronson works for Sheldon Whitehouse. And somebody, by the way, you should meet. He's another law dog and really wonderful guy. And Sheldon Whitehouse has been doing all kinds of, if you don't already know him, his office is doing all sorts of stuff to track sort of the vast right-wing conspiracy in funding the current modern courts. And I use that language intentionally and accurately. That is actually what's been going on. We've never seen anything like it in the history of the world. And it's manipulating the courts. And the best phrase I saw, and I got it from a journalist of all things, was saying, this is the, don't call it the Roberts Court, call it the Dark Money Court. This is the dark money era of the Supreme Court. And when Moore versus Harper came out, it was one of the early cases announced by the Supreme Court, as I understood it. And people were saying, oh, Hosanna, Hosanna, isn't that great? And he commented, I threw on a website called twitter.com. He commented, just wait. The Supreme Court controls the docket. What this tells me, this is Justice Roberts sort of saying, hey, nothing to see here. It's not going to be too dangerous. We are a court that can be trusted, maintain sort of credibility of the judicial branch. And in order to cover over the fact that real bad stuff is coming, I share that with you. And immediately when I read this, oh, he's totally right. This is going to get bad. And of course, he was totally right. It got real, real bad. How are you feeling about the Supreme Court right now? And how should people be feeling about the Supreme Court right now?
I think the court got it right in Moore and Merrill in the two big democracy decisions on its docket this year. But that doesn't mean, well, I'll first say, but what it did in those two cases was uphold the status quo. It did not bring justice to bear. It did not rectify all of the wrongs that it has done to voting rights over the last two decades. All it did was keep the status quo in place. Section 2, vote dilution lawsuits could continue to go on, and state checks and balances remain in place. That's good. Those are good outcomes, but that is nothing new. That was the state of affairs before. At the same time, it made very extreme rulings this term and last term on LGBTQ rights, affirmative action, guns, and abortion, of course, among many others. So nothing about those two election decisions, which were, as I said, good, they were the right decisions, undoes the harm that the court has done to democracy in the last two decades, undoes the harm that the court has done to our, you know, to the goal of racial equality, undoes the harm to the LGBTQ community, undoes the harm to women seeking reproductive justice. So I think we still have an extraordinarily extreme court that is willing to buck precedent and manipulate history to reach certain outcomes. So I don't feel, these two decisions don't assuage me. They don't make me feel particularly confident that we're in a new, more moderate era of the Supreme Court. I think those are the right decisions, and it reflects lots of work by the lawyers and the parties and the amici and in those two cases. But there's a lot of work still to be done with respect to court reform more broadly, and a lot of work still to be done to protect the rights that the court is eviscerating in its other cases.
If anybody ever named their child amici, it just seems like that's it's there to be done, right? Somebody's got to do it at some point. We should touch on the Merrill case. So Merrill versus Milligan, maybe now Allen versus Milligan. What is the short version? Alabama's got to create upholding the district court decision that Alabama's got to create a second majority Black congressional district in compliance with Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. Shortest version, explain that one.
So the case arose in 2021. A group of Black voters and Black-led community and civil rights organizations filed a lawsuit after Alabama drew its new congressional maps, saying that the legislature had packed Black voters into one district and otherwise cracked communities of Black voters to dilute their political power. Under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, minority groups can sue to force states or localities to change their voting maps if they show that racially polarized voting interacts with the design of the maps to make it impossible for minority communities to win political power. And that's exactly what Black voters argued happened in Alabama. Ultimately, the Supreme Court agreed. They agreed that that there was racial discrimination in the way that the lines were drawn and that Black votes were diluted, and they affirmed the lower court decision. They also affirmed, crucially, the test that is used to discern whether there has been discrimination under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act with respect to line drawing. And going into the case, there was every fear and worry that the court was about to eviscerate Section 2 vote dilution claims, because just a couple of years ago, the court undermined the ability to bring Section 2 claims alleging vote denial, alleging that there had been burdens on the right of individual voters to be able to cast their ballots. That's in a case called Brnovich. So there was a strong fear here that the Supreme Court was poised to undermine the ability to push back against racial discrimination under Section 2. That isn't what happened. And the court upheld the lower court decision. Crucially, the Supreme Court also rejected a very extreme argument that Alabama was advancing in that case, which was that Alabama essentially argued that the only possible remedy that could be offered had to be entirely race neutral. In other words, Alabama was saying the way to fix race discrimination is by being completely race neutral. And the court rejected that and said that the Voting Rights Act contemplates that race can be taken into account when remedying racially discriminatory maps. So that was an incredibly important rejection of an extreme view offered in this Alabama case. Of course, you know, several weeks later in the affirmative action cases, the court has very strenuously rejected and overturned the ability to take race into account in the context of college applications and considerations. So there's a distinction there that is quite meaningful in the higher education context now.
Liza Swerenbecker, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you for your work. What are you working on next, if you're allowed to say?
Well, one of the things that I'm working on is trying to advance federal democracy reform legislation that will improve voting access across the country and will push back against racially discriminatory voting practices. As I noted, the Supreme Court's decision in Merrill and the Supreme Court's decision in Moore left us with the status quo. And the status quo ain't that great right now. The Supreme Court has eviscerated the Voting Rights Act in the Shelby County case. It undermined the ability to bring litigation under Section 2 in the Brnovich case. And the past several years have seen states undercut voting rights at every turn, making it harder and harder for voters to be able to cast their ballots. We desperately need federal democracy reform to lift the floor of voting access for everybody and to protect against racial discrimination in voting. So we are continuing to call for the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. I don't pretend that there is a high likelihood of passage in this particular Congress, but I think it's important to note that nothing about the decisions out of the Supreme Court and Merrill and Moore obviate the need for that federal democracy reform. It's needed extremely acutely, and that's one of the things that I will continue to work on until the day that passage is possible.
Well, I hope that happens sooner rather than later, and I appreciate the plug because that's a good tease for the next conversation that I hope we have a chance to have. Again, Liza Swerenbecker of the Brennan Center, thanks for the time. Thanks for being an amici among the amici of democracy, for being an amici of the show, among the amici, an amicus of the show, and thanks for being a democracy nerd.
Thank you, Jeff. It's great to be here.
Be well.
Democracy Nerds, recorded in sunny Portland, Oregon, produced by Kyle Curtis. Thanks also to technical producer Sig Seeliger. Logo designed by Kat Buckley at kbuckleygraphics.com. I am Jefferson Smith. Thank you so much for listening. You can rate and review. Hope you will. And follow Democracy Nerd on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Past episodes of the show, Democracy Nerd, can be found online at democracynerd.us. Go America. Thank you. Thank you, democracy.